When a 15-year-old Massachusetts student named Phoebe Prince killed herself in 2010, the headlines screamed, "Bullied to death," and six of her fellow students at South Hadley High School faced charges. But as Emily Bazelon says, the story is not that simple. She writes that Prince was deeply troubled long before she ever met the six defendants. She also says there is no single type of bullying experience, and often there aren't even clear-cut bullies and victims. The internet complicates the picture, especially for parents. Bazelon is a senior editor at Slate, and for her new book, she spoke with kids who were bullied, kids who did the bullying, parents, teachers, and school administrators. It's called Sticks and Stones: Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power and Character of Empathy. And in this past weekend's New York Times Book Review, Andrew Solomon called Emily Bazelon a compassionate champion for justice in the domain of childhood's essential unfairness. Emily joins me in the studio to talk about her book. Emily, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
Emily, I want to start with that part about the essential unfairness of childhood. And can you tell us how we decide when kids just being mean to each other in a way that helps us grow into functioning adults becomes bullying?
The definition of bullying that makes sense to me is that it is physical or verbal abuse that is repeated over time and involves a power imbalance. You're not talking about a one-off fight, and you're not talking about what the kids often call drama, which goes back and forth. You're talking about one kid or a group of kids really making it their business to make a kid miserable over time.
So by that definition, is it clear that Phoebe Prince and the other students you write about were bullied?
I think Phoebe Prince was bullied, particularly on the day of her death. There were students who called her names. There's no question that she was upset about that. The part of the South Hadley story that I have questions about is the district attorney's characterization that the bullying was relentless and took place over a period of months. I don't think that that is really what happened.
So what's so interesting, or one of many interesting things, is that through the eyes of one of the students who were charged after Phoebe Prince's suicide, I'm thinking about Flannery Mullins. Do I understand correctly that Flannery didn't even really think Phoebe was bullied?
I think Flannery thought she did not bully Phoebe because she wasn't one of the kids who was calling Phoebe names or was involved in any way on what happened on the day of Phoebe's death. And she saw herself as engaged in a two-way conflict with Phoebe. Basically, Flannery had a boyfriend who Phoebe was also interested in.
But in the eyes of others, that became something more.
There really were different sets of conflicts involved in Phoebe Prince and in these allegations of bullying. And one of the questions I raise is whether we lumped all the six kids together as the South Hadley Six, when in fact they had very different degrees of culpability.
Do you think it's fair to say that the Phoebe Prince case didn't just get the most reaction of many of the national bullying cases we've heard about, but the most overreaction?
Well, I mean, when a teenager commits suicide, you want there to be a big reaction. I think the problem was the oversimplifying of the narrative. This was a hugely sad story. It was just a different sad story than the one that we heard in the first few months after Phoebe's death.
On that note of oversimplifying a narrative, can you give an example of when you found that the lines between bully and victim blur, that it's a little gray?
Right. So there's a whole category of kids, and they're called bully victims, and they are kids who both lash out and are victimized. They're often kids who have a lot of trouble socially. Sometimes they end up doing the dirty work for the more clever, manipulative bullies.
You wrote about two other students as well. Could you briefly tell us their stories, starting with Monique McLean?
Monique McLean was a seventh grader at a school in Connecticut called Woodrow Wilson Middle School. And she came to school during the first week with a new hairstyle she was excited about. Unfortunately for her, it was a hairstyle that another girl on her bus already had. And this sounds trivial, and it should have been, but there were two bigger eighth graders who started calling Monique a biter. That was their word for copycat. And partly because of the no man's land on the bus, and partly because the school was a kind of chaotic place, this really escalated. It turned into name-calling and taunting and throwing things at Monique on the bus, and it also moved into school. And eventually, her mother got so upset about the school's lack of response that she pulled Monique out of school.
And what about Jacob Lasher?
Jacob Lasher is a boy in upstate New York who started coming to school with his fingernails polished and his hair dyed in seventh and eighth grade. In some parts of the country, that wouldn't be a big deal. But in Jacob's school, to really push the gender boundaries was very unusual. And the other kids couldn't handle it. They started taunting Jacob, and then his situation became violent. Kids actually pushed him down the stairs. And again, what was hard was that this continued for a long period of time without an adequate response. response from the school. And so his parents finally got very frustrated and convinced the New York Civil Liberties Union to take the case. Jacob successfully sued his school and got some money for himself and, more importantly, some promises and commitments from the school to improve their approach to dealing with gay students.
And part of what you try to look at is what is the responsibility of parents as well as administrators. In fact, there was a lawyer writer who told you that she has, in a very, of course, lawyerly term, probable cause standard for when she checks her daughter's phone and online accounts. So do you think that parents should consider it their obligation to monitor their kids' online lives, to be on bullying watch?
I think parents, particularly when their kids first go online and start using social media and texting with phones, really need to think of this as a new mode of communication and a new world their kids are entering. So, you know, the same way I wouldn't open the door at midnight and tell my 13-year-old to go take a walk, I also am not going to just have him turn on his computer and start signing up for social media accounts without guiding him through that. So, for example, does your kid need a smartphone with the internet and a camera when it's his first phone? Or maybe you should try something, what I call a dumb phone, that can only text and only take phone calls. Not that the children actually are interested in making or receiving phone calls. It's those kinds of incremental steps, making sure that you've really thought about whether the technology you're giving your kid access to is something that he can handle.
And as you say, also parents have to decide when they just stay back. And it may be painful to watch, but they have to let their kids grow up and learn how to cope with things that are going to be hard when you're older too.
Right. I mean, that's not something I advise when you think your kid is really being bullied. But it is true that if we start over-diagnosing bullying, if we start calling every fight bullying and intervening, then we're not going to give kids the skills they need to learn how to solve their own problems.
I want to go back to Monique McLean and Jacob Lasher, the other two students you wrote about. You gave us a little thumbnail description of them. What are the lessons to be learned from their cases of bullying? Anything different than we already learned from Phoebe Prince?
I know that schools have huge demands that are placed on them, and I want to emphasize that parents really have a lot of responsibility in preventing bullying. But in these particular cases, the schools made specific mistakes. So in Monique's case, an assistant principal suggested peer mediation, and Monique's mother just intuitively knew that these bullies were going to say exactly what the adults wanted to hear in the room and then turn on Monique for being a snitch once she walked out the door. In the case of Jacob's school, there was another student, an older student, who had tried to start a gay-straight alliance a few years before Jacob came to school. Those organizations can be really important for helping to protect gay kids and just helping everybody who is dealing with sexuality. And this school refused to grant official recognition to the gay-straight alliance, and as a result, it shut down.
Emily Bazelon is a senior editor at Slate. Her new book about bullying is Sticks and Stones. We'll continue talking with her after a 60-second break, including about stepping in to try to stop bullying and what kids and parents can do. We'll also hear what Facebook is doing to prevent cyberbullying. Emily paid a visit to Facebook headquarters to find out. And later in today's show, Detroit's finances are so poor that the city may get an emergency financial manager. We'll find out how that process would work. This is Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Emily Bazelon about her new book on bullying. It's called Sticks and Stones, and it looks at the issue through the stories of kids who have been bullied, including a 13-year-old girl from Connecticut named Monique McLean. Her mother pulled her out of school after months of bullying. Emily, in that case, no one really stepped in to stop the bullying. What could have been done?
One of the most important things to prevent bullying is for kids to see that adults care and that adults take action. One of the lines I like about this is, if it's mean, intervene. In other words, adults really need to help set the tone about what is acceptable at a school and what's not.
What about the students themselves? I mean, because you mentioned in the book that you had a situation, I think, where New York on the subway, where you felt like you were witnessing bullying, felt obligated to step in because you basically study bullying, ended up feeling very embarrassed. You wondered if that's why people don't intervene more.
Right. Well, it struck me when I was trying myself to stand up to what I perceived to be some teenage bullies that this is really hard to do. When people are yelling and they seem stronger and more powerful than you, to be the person who takes a stand can often mean turning yourself into an object of humiliation. And so it really drove home to me that we're asking a lot of kids. My answer to that is I think we can give kids things to do that are smaller and more realistic. There are ways in which kids can stand with the victim as opposed to standing up to the bully. So, for example, you can counsel kids to send a sympathetic text message after they see someone who's hurt, or to just go up to them in the hall and ask them if they're okay. And in polls of kids who've been bullied, when they were asked what their peers did that helped the most, those were the kinds of actions they mentioned.
So even if not stepping in the moment, it still is helpful to do something later.
Exactly. These small moments of empathy can actually make a huge difference.
Emily, I know from your book jacket that you have two sons. How old are they, and how are you navigating the bullying world with your kids?
My boys are 10 and 13. They would tell you that it is a grave misfortune to have a mother who is writing about bullying, and in particular about technology. And, you know, we really have tried to take incremental steps, giving them access to the internet and access to their phones. We've also made mistakes along the way. So, for example, my 13-year-old did get his own phone this year. And one night, I realized he was sleeping with it under his pillow because he was texting with the friend. And that was the beginning in our house of a rule that the phones charge downstairs at night. The reason for that is just that, what if he got an upsetting message in the middle of the night? That could unsettle him, and it wouldn't be clear to him what to do about it. So I want to make sure that he's using this technology, again, in a way that he can handle.
So somehow managing or overseeing technology plays a huge role in this, and this connects to the trip you made to Facebook for your book. What did you find out that Facebook is trying to do to deal with online bullying or cyberbullying?
Facebook has a policy against bullying and harassment, and that means they are getting millions of complaints about it every week. They have some people on staff who are tasked with going through those reports. It's not a large number, and that means that their staff is working extremely quickly. That means they sometimes drop the ball, and that happened while I was in their office. I showed them a Facebook page that had caused a lot of trouble at Monique's school and that an educator there had complained about, but Facebook had not caught his complaint. They had just missed it. The other thing I learned about Facebook that day is they're really not doing very much to work directly with schools. For example, the idea of having just an email Dropbox that educators could use to flag for them big problems arising at their schools. At that point, when I visited, Facebook had not tried that. They've since started a pilot project, but in the year and a half since my visit, it has remained very small. So this just does not seem to me to be a real priority for them.
Your book, besides just making clear that there is no one-size-fits-all bullying, also says that there's no one-size-fits-all approach to dealing with bullying. But are there at least some guidelines? Are there three things that schools, parents, school administrators can do to try to prevent or deal with this when it happens?
The most important thing is for kids to really learn how to express and regulate their emotions and really build up their capacities for empathy. That's the best kind of prevention. That's something parents can do at home in a simple way around the dinner table. It's really as easy as asking your kid to imagine what it's like to be in someone else's shoes. And schools can also help build up this capacity, particularly in the younger grades, by concretely thinking about and sometimes having programs that specifically address how kids feel and giving them strategies for dealing with their emotions when they seem out of control.
The title of your book, by the way, Sticks and Stones, does it tell us that that thing we were taught by our parents when we were little, sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me? That's actually quite a useless aphorism in the end, because the opposite is true?
It is useless. One of the most striking things to me about bullying, and honestly, this has surprised me in the time I've reported on it, is that it's associated with long-term as well as short-term psychological harm.
In fact, you say that you've been surprised by how many adults tell you that their memories of bullying are still so vivid and painful.
That's one of the reasons that I was drawn to writing about this topic, because I think these are foundational formative memories for us. And there was a new study from Duke that just came out a couple of weeks ago in which kids who were bullied or were bullies and victims all the way back at age 9, they were asked 20 years later how they were doing. And those kids had strikingly higher rates of anxiety and depression and suicidal thinking. The researcher, who's not someone who normally studies bullying, said to me that he was so taken with these findings that he really feels like the field of psychology needs to take this kind of harmful peer relationship just as seriously as it takes child abuse. And that's a very different way of thinking than our current approach.
Based on what you see in schools today, do you think kids in school now, 20, 30 years from now, will be as damaged as some of the adults tell you they are from their childhoods?
I think we're in the middle of a cultural shift. I really think schools and parents are taking bullying seriously and trying to concentrate on it. You know, if you look at other problems relating to teenagers, like drunk driving, when we came together as a society and made a mass effort to change this, it worked. The rates of drunk driving amongst kids and deaths from drunk driving have dropped significantly. So it really takes everyone coming together to change a social norm, but it is possible.
Emily Bazelon is a senior editor at Slate. Her new book is Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power and Character of Empathy. You can read an excerpt at hereandnow.org. Emily, thanks for coming to the studio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell us what you've done or haven't done when you've witnessed what you consider to be bullying. And let us know if you think there are times when parents should hold back and let kids resolve bullying situations on their own. Go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us to send an email or scroll down and leave a comment. To join us on Facebook, go to facebook.com/hereandnowradio. News is next, Here and Now.